This is Interviews, a podcast from the National Academy of Sciences that provides first-person accounts of the lives and work of Academy members. In this series of one-on-one conversations, scientists talk about what inspired them to pursue the careers they chose and describe some of the most fascinating aspects of their research.
Despite her engineer father's best attempts to dissuade her from following in his footsteps, Ellen Williams was a born scientist. She grew up tinkering and taking things apart, and when she discovered chemistry in high school, she was hooked. Williams' interest in chemistry, and in particular her interest in what happens to the stuff around us on the very smallest scales, led her from Michigan to the California Institute of Technology, where she worked to understand the catalysts that speed up common chemical reactions, and where she met her husband, the astrophysicist Neil Garrels. Later, when the two made their way to Maryland, Williams pioneered the use of very powerful electron scanning tunneling microscopes to study electronic materials like silicon. Her insights have helped engineers develop more stable circuits in computers and other electronics, and may one day give rise to more stable nanodevices, minuscule machines with a big impact on everything from microchips to medicine. Williams is a distinguished professor of physics at the University of Maryland, where she has worked since 1981. She was elected to the National Academy of Sciences in 2005.
My name is Ellen Williams. I'm a professor of physics at the University of Maryland. My area of specialty is condensed matter physics. Well, I was born in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. My parents moved to Michigan when I was just a baby. My father was a mechanical engineer. He worked at Ford Motor Company. So I grew up in the Detroit area. It was a great place to grow up, an area with a good industrial base and therefore good schools and a good educational system. I think if I had been a boy, my father would have encouraged me to be an engineer, but he felt very strongly that an engineer's life was very, very hard for women, and he, in fact, actively discouraged me from considering engineering. My father was quite a bit older. He didn't have children until relatively late in his life. So he grew up, he was born in 1917, grew up and went to school during the Great Depression. And after he was out of school, he worked in industry. And in those days, an engineer worked on the floor in a factory. And they worked with very tough guys. And I believe that, you know, an engineer had to be a kind of a guy who could get there on the floor with those muscle men and show his elbow a little bit and really face guys down. And so that was his perspective on what it took to be an engineer. And from his perspective, it was probably the way things were. And he didn't see that as a career for a girl. Things obviously have changed in the intervening years, but the end result was that by the time he had any sons, which was there was me and then my sister, and then quite a bit later he got two boys, but by that time he was older and less engaged with the children. So he never got a child who was an engineer. My son would have been the one for my father. I kind of regret that my father died when my son was 8 or 9 years old, and so he never really got to see Tommy develop, but Tommy's going into electrical engineering, and he would have been the child that my father would have really clicked with as a fellow engineer. So, but I could have been that child if I'd been a boy.
Well, did he have anything in mind for you?
Yes, he did. He knew I was a smart kid, and I remember when I was very small, I remember that there was some stress between him and my mother because he wanted me to go to private school and she was just not having any of that. She figured that was just an unnecessary expense and hoity-toity and just out of the question. So there was a lot of tension. There was some tension there over that. But he knew I was a smart kid. And when I was in high school, he strongly encouraged me to go into computer programming, which at that time, that was I was in high school from 69 to 72. So at that time, you know, computers were nothing like computers are today. And I did, in high school, take a class in computer programming after school. We had an opportunity to go to our city board of education. They had a computer. And four or five of the kids went after school and learned Fortran programming on this computer. This computer It was so primitive. I'm sure that its capability was far lower than the capability you can get on the cheapest little thin flat panel calculator you can buy today. But anyway, we learned computer programming, and I kind of liked it. But at the same time, I was taking chemistry in high school, and I just loved it. I had a great teacher, and I enjoyed it so much. I went to a summer science program sponsored by the National Science Foundation, did chemistry for 6 weeks, met other kids like me, and so it was exciting and it was fun. So when I went off to college, I decided I would major in chemistry. I was kind of thinking that I wanted to go to medical school because I didn't know what a scientist did or had no idea that science could be an interesting thing. But after a year or two and seeing that science seemed to be a thing that you could actually do, I decided to just stay with chemistry. So I got my degree in physical chemistry, discovered fairly early that there are different types of people and different ways of thinking about chemistry and science in general. And I seem to be a statistical mechanics kind of person. I liked statistical things, entropy and randomness and understanding how things work in terms of the disordered world. And so even then, it's very funny to see that there seem to be some kind of innate preferences that different people have and how they choose what's interesting and exciting to them. So I went off to graduate school and I went to Caltech. Not for any particularly informed reasons. I think I wanted to go to California. I had looked at polymer chemistry a bit when I was an undergraduate and found polymer chemistry very interesting. There's a lot of interesting statistics there. And I kind of wanted to work with a guy at Stanford who was a big-time polymer chemist, but he had retired, and so it was almost a flip of the coin. I went to Caltech, and that turned out to be a wonderful decision for me. Caltech's a great place.
Yeah. What attracted you? You said you were very interested in the statistical side of things. What attracted you about that?
Well, I just conclude that different people's brains click into different types of enterprises that are interesting in science, and mine seems to be an interest in things that are kind of thermodynamically or statistically mechanically oriented, and I think I think people are born with certain aspects of their personality and their way their brain works built in. Certainly having children has taught me that there's a lot of things about human beings that are just there. You're not going to change those.
So you got out to California.
I got out to California. I was at Caltech. What an amazing place. I had been at Michigan State University, which is a huge public university. I went to California, which of course, first of all, is like a totally different world. I remember getting off the plane for the first time and seeing all those palm trees, and it was like, oh my goodness, where am I? this is so exotic. And Caltech's a very small university, and it was wonderful because there I was at Caltech. Everybody else was just like me. They were interested in the same thing I was. Everybody was ambitious. You don't stick out as an unusual person because you're motivated and driven. It's the norm. So it was a great social environment. You know, a big change to be in that social environment where working hard and being excited about what you're doing and being very driven was just normal. It wasn't something you had to hide or be embarrassed about or worry about.
Did you feel that way at Michigan?
I think all my life. You know, you're always a little bit the odd egg out, and you realize that you want to make sure that nobody knows about that 95 you got on your test. You kind of hide it away so nobody knows, and because it just doesn't buy you anything good. So anyway, it was a wonderful 5 years that I was there.
Were there other women in your program?
That's an interesting thing. In my class, I was in chemistry, not in physics. In my class, there was a fluke that year. They accidentally admitted a class of 40 people in chemistry, which was much bigger than they had expected, and 10 of them were women. So my year had an anomalous number of women in chemistry, and there were also two or three women in physics that year. And so it was a little bit more women than normal, and looking back on it, we weren't the most normal group of people. We were all a little bit odd, and uh, unusual in our perspectives, but at Caltech we fit right in. To a certain extent, it didn't matter that you were a woman because all that really mattered was how well you were doing. Socially, it mattered. You would go to a party and the women would find each other. Oh, other women. And we'd stand and we'd be talking, you know, how women talk. So we'd be sitting, standing there talking. And then you'd suddenly look up and you'd look around and this group of four or five women who were standing there talking, there would be a ring of men standing around, kind of looking, listening, paying attention. It was the oddest phenomenon you could possibly imagine. So that was anyway, it was fun to be there. I lived in the dorm for the first 2 years I was there. There were no women's dorms at that point, and there never have been a women's graduate dorm. There's now, I think, a women's undergraduate dorm. But for the most part, the women at Caltech have been integrated in the normal dorm structure, which at that time was a very unusual thing. And Caltech basically did it because there weren't enough women to have a whole dorm. So anyway, I lived in the dorm, and so that was an interesting lifestyle for a couple of years. But mostly, the most important thing was the academic environment. And so I was in chemistry, took chemistry classes, but in chemistry they were very focused on getting you involved in research as quickly as possible. So within the first year, everybody was looking to select a research group. And I applied for and was admitted to a research group in surface science, surface chemistry. And my advisor was Henry Weinberg. He was in the chemical engineering department. He had a joint appointment between chemistry and chemical engineering. And he was doing what was then this hot new field of surface chemistry. And so I joined that group.
Why did you want to be in that group?
Why did I want to be in that group? You know, again, this was one of those things that I wasn't making very informed decisions. I didn't really have anybody to help me or give me advice, and so I just kind of staggered through my life making decisions on the basis of what looked good to me. And the way that it worked in graduate school is that you'd come in, they had a series of seminars where the faculty would come and the graduate students would listen to them talk, and the graduate students were required and encouraged to go and talk to a number of different faculty. And I went and talked to Weinberg, and I was very excited by what he was doing. And there was another thing that happened which was really interesting, which is that the women clustered. There were a small number of groups that had anomalous numbers of women in them. And I don't quite understand how that happened, but it must have been, you know, something about the research advisor that was more welcoming, because there was a very distinct clustering phenomenon, which was pretty odd. So I and two other women joined Henry's group that year, Pat Teal and Sarah, I can't remember her last name, she left with a master's degree, but Pat Teal, who joined the same year that I did, has remained one of my very good friends all these years. I know exactly where she is and what she's doing and who her children are. And those kind of connections last with you for your whole life. And Henry, in subsequent years, had a fair number of other women join his group as well. So that was interesting. So I joined this surface chemistry group, and it was like no kind of chemistry I'd ever been exposed to as an undergraduate. The work is all done in vacuum systems, which are big mechanical things that involve screws and bolts and machines, and none of those things that I ever was exposed to as an undergraduate. And I'd never been exposed to as a child, because my dad didn't think that girls were going to do engineering. So you know, when he was down in his shop tinkering with his lawnmower motor or setting up his model train set or whatever it was, the girls weren't welcome, because that wasn't what girls were supposed to do. So I suddenly had to jump into this new world where I had to pretend that I knew that you turned the screw clockwise to screw it in, which I didn't know until somebody kindly taught me a mnemonic, clockwise close. So I learned which way to turn a screw in. And boy, talk about jumping in over your head. But I thrashed around a bit, and my guess is that, in fact, I wasn't jumping in over my head really much more than other people were. But I think guys are much better at presenting that persona of, you know, I know what I'm doing, I'm on top of it, even when they're just as confused as girls are.
In fact, I do advising now, so I have undergraduates who I'm advisors to, and I've occasionally had girls or female undergraduate advisees come to me and, oh, I'm so confused. I'm doing so poorly in my class. I don't understand what's going on. I got a B. I said, you got a B? Well, you know, you're better than average. She says, no, everybody else in the class knows better than I do. I said, well, what was the average on the last score test? 85. What did you get? 87. I said, how could you not? How could everybody understand better than you if you got better than the average? You know, and she listens to the guys in the class talking, and they're, oh, we know what we're up to. This is all about this, that, and the other thing. And she doesn't understand that that's all bluff and bravado. And so there's a real, it's not quite cultural difference, but girls grow up learning to talk and learning to interact in a very different way than guys do. And girls will talk about their weakness and the things that they're confused about or the things that's bothering them, and guys never do that. And when you're in that environment, you see these guys and they're all talking like they really know what they're doing, it can really undermine your self-confidence. So that's a hard one to learn. I like watching the girls my daughter's age. They're so confident, and they just, you know, never occurred to them they couldn't do everything they want to. It's a different world. It's great. So anyway, I did well. And of course, in addition to science, I also met my husband there. So he lived in the dorm, and he was in physics. So we met, and we got married at Caltech. We got married in the gardens at Caltech with all our graduate student friends around, and that was a cool thing too. And so he won the Draper Prize today. So yes.
Wow! Yes. Congratulations.
Yes. So I'm very proud of him. So I had a great education. Plus, I got my, you know, I got my husband. I always said I got the best one.
And just so our listeners know, your husband is?
Neil Garrels. He's an astrophysicist. He does gamma ray astronomy. He's at Goddard Space Flight Center, and he won the Draper Prize today for his work with gamma ray bursts.
What sorts of experiments and problems were you working on when you were at Caltech?
Okay, so my advisor was a chemical engineer, and the types of problems we were involved with were problems relating to the field of chemical catalysis. So a catalyst is a chemical which, when you place it in the context of a chemical reaction, so you've got some chemical reaction that makes something that you want, it makes the reaction go faster. It's not consumed in the reaction. It's there. It participates in the reaction. But by the time the reaction's over, the catalyst is still there. So it's this magical thing that makes chemical reactions go faster. So the experiments and the type of science I was doing at that time were oriented at really getting down to the single atom scale, trying to understand how did this work. And at that point, it was known that how it worked had to do with the atoms on the surface. So the catalyst is often, let's say you have a reaction where you're trying to react a hydrocarbon and get it to release energy, and it's going to go to CO2. Often those types of chemical reactions involve a catalyst that's a metal. And so you would have these chunks of metal that would act as a catalyst. And it was known at that time that what was happening in some sense was that what the metal was doing is it was serving as a binding site. So your reactive molecule, say your hydrocarbon, would come in and it would stick on the surface of this metal. And then the other molecule that it was supposed to react with would also come in and stick on the surface of this metal. And the metal would weaken the chemical bonds in those molecules and allow them to come together and react to form new chemical bonds. So the experiments I was involved with had to do with really cleaning up the system, controlling the variables, and trying to do these experiments with a metal surface where you knew exactly what the structure of the atoms on the metal surface was, and then bring in the molecules one at a time, carefully measure how they stuck to the surface, what happened to their chemical bonds, and then bring in another molecule and try to get them together and really understand what it was about the interactions of these molecules, one with the other, that made the reaction go faster on the metal surface than it would if the metal surface wasn't there.
What did you do after Caltech?
So after Caltech, since I got married towards the end of my graduate career, my husband and I were then in this very difficult dual career situation of trying to find two jobs in the same place. But fortunately, I was very interested in a group at University of Maryland that had been working on fundamental issues of how molecules interact on surfaces. And Neil, my husband, is an astrophysicist, and he wanted to go to Goddard Space Flight Center to work in their gamma ray group. And so, as it happened, we both got postdocs, and so that worked out really well. It was quite a relief. And so I went to a physics department as opposed to a chemistry department. I didn't realize at the time what a big traumatic change that was, but I moved into a physics department being a chemist and kept doing experiments and having a good time. So then I went through a period of years basically learning undergraduate physics by teaching it. So I learned undergraduate physics by teaching it and kind of established a career in physics, but I had to kind of change the orientation of what I was doing. Surface chemistry, catalysis, chemical reactions, that doesn't fit in a physics department. And so I made a transition in the emphasis of my work from chemical catalysis and chemical reactions to electronic materials, so things like silicon. And electronic materials, again, a lot of the way that the transistors in your computer work and the memory devices that store information in your computer have a lot to do with interfaces and the boundaries between two materials. And so that becomes a surface problem again. So I had to make this transition of how to focus my research to something that's useful and applicable to technology and to social needs. And that was tough. It took some time, but I found very exciting and useful things to do with silicon. So,
tell us about some of those exciting and useful things.
Okay, well, let's see. So silicon is just a really remarkable material. And so one of the fundamental questions that I was interested in that becomes important as devices get smaller and smaller is, if I've got a silicon surface, why does it stay flat? Is it necessarily the case that if I take a piece of material and I slice it to expose a surface and I start doing things to it, is it necessarily going to stay flat? And during the processing and the chemical reaction that you're going to do to this surface, is it really going to stay flat, or is it going to get rougher? And it turns out that degree of flatness and that degree of roughness is really important for how these electronic materials work. And that turned out to be a tremendously interesting problem. It's related to problems what are called equilibrium crystal shape. So, you know, if you take a piece of jewelry, it's a solid and it's got nice, sharp, flat surfaces. Okay, but they're not just any surface. Those surfaces, if you look at them under an electron microscope, are surfaces where there's a specific arrangement of atoms on the surface. And so if I take a crystal and it's got two flat surfaces like this and there's a corner there, suppose I decided I was going to slice that crystal and cut off the corner and make a new flat surface. That surface very likely won't stay flat. If you heat that surface up and let the atoms do what they want to do to minimize their energy, that surface, that corner that you cut off, it's very likely that it will spontaneously arrange itself into a zigzag structure so that the surfaces on those zigzags that are exposed are the same ones on the flat surfaces of that crystal. And that's because the atoms bind to each other, they interact with each other, and there's some sets of interactions that are favorable. And those, if you give the atoms the freedom to diffuse and move around, will govern the structure of the surface in such a way that flat isn't the best. And so we did, we spent about 10 years from the late 80s until the late 90s looking at all sorts of different silicon surfaces and understanding what it was that determined when they stayed flat and when they broke up into a zigzag structure. And so what we could do, because we could see it with a tunneling microscope and we could see all the individual atoms, at that point allowed us to develop a predictive understanding. We could not just explain what we were seeing, but you could come to me and ask me a question and say, what's going to happen if I do this? And I could say, if you do that, the surface will get rough, or if you do that, the surface will stay smooth. There's a very well-known failure mode in computer circuits. So if you run your computer for a long time, every once in a while it will make a mistake. Something will fail or something will break. It doesn't happen very often, but the most common source of failure in electronic materials in computer circuitry is something called an electromigration failure. And what that means is when you run electrical current through a wire for a long time, the electrons are moving through the wire and they're hitting the atoms in the wire, and bing, 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 they're very, very little, but you know, after a long time, a large number of little hits on a big atom will push it. And eventually you get into a situation where electromigration can push the atoms around in a wire and make it break. And so we discovered that we could, in a very fundamental way, run electrical current through a piece of silicon and watch, because we could measure the structure of the surface evolving as we were running the current through it, we could see the very beginning stages of that process. We could almost see individual atoms start to be pushed around. And so we could go in and we could actually measure exactly what the effect is of these electrons hitting these atoms on the surface and tell you it's going to take 27 hours. Well, it's never 27 hours. It's much longer than that. But you, if you flow this much current through your material, through your silicon sample or through your transistor or through your wire, it's going to take a certain amount of time, and we can tell you what that time is going to be before the atoms move around long enough for the wire to break. And the next stage is, instead of predicting when bad things are going to happen, which we're thinking about now, is trying to figure out how to use those sorts of forces to direct the evolution of structures to make new things that you might want, instead of just things that are preventing things that are bad.
Obviously, you and your husband were quite lucky in finding positions in the same place and being able to stay there. But even so, I'm sure your careers have demanded a lot of you over the years. How have you balanced that with, you know, having your family and your home life?
I think, well, of course, I could be wrong because I only have one experience. I think it might be easier in a family where both people are scientists. Both of us made a commitment. In fact, it was part of our marriage vows to support each other in our careers. And so through all the years, we've always worked complementary schedules, balanced shared workloads around the house. When our children were born, we took a huge hit on our social interactions between the two of us. We would take turns in the evenings. One of us would be with the children, a child, or at first one of us would be with our son while the other one could go and work. And then when we had a second child, it was in the evenings and the weekends, one of us would be with one child, one of us would be with the other child, taking care of children. So we were constantly trading off and balancing each other's workloads so that we could take care of the children, give them what they needed, and at the same time maximize what each of us could do professionally. You know, now my children are both in college, and we're kind of like rediscovering each other. It's like, wow, we've got this marriage. We get to see each other once in a while.
What do you think some of the biggest obstacles you've encountered in your career have been?
Looking back, I would say that you know, the fact that I kind of plunged into a scientific career rather blindly, just because it was what I wanted to do, and I didn't really have anybody to give me advice or suggest what I should be doing. I would say that for young people going into a science career, having a mentor, someone who can advise them as to how to make good choices, that's something I think I missed. I think I missed a lot in those early years. For me, moving from chemistry to physics was a hard transition. It was hard to you lose when you change fields, you lose the fundamental contacts that your research advisor have that smooths the pathway for you. Being a woman in a field where at that time, you know, there was a lot of pushback Women were just moving into science, and I would frequently encounter a situation where someone would say, oh, you only got that because you're a woman. You know, you got that grant because you're a woman. If you'd been a man competing on an even playing field, you wouldn't have gotten that grant. That wasn't true. I don't think it was true at all. But at the time, it really undermines your confidence to not know, well, am I really competent, or is what he's saying true? Am I just, you know, an incompetent person who just got this grant because I was a woman? And so that was a hard thing to deal with, that kind of demoralizing situation. I hope that's less of a problem nowadays.
What advice would you give to a young person interested in a career in science?
Find a mentor. Talk to professors or other people in a scientific career, and be a little pushy about it, and ask a lot of questions. I think number two would be, recognize that what you like, what you find enjoyable, is in fact what you're likely to do best. So don't try to fit yourself as a square peg in a round hole. Find the hole that's the right shape for your interests. And even if it doesn't look like perhaps it's the most exciting or the most sexy thing on the block that year, in the long term, you can, if you invest, become the best at what you do, there's a path forward.
Since 1863, the nation's top scientists have been honored with membership in the National Academy of Sciences. Today, there are more than 2,500 in the NAS membership, of whom approximately 200 have won Nobel Prizes. We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Interviews, and invite you to join us again for another inspiring conversation.